This is History's Hidden Killers. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
All right, let me walk you through one of the harder facts about the BTK case, which is a BTK case. It's kind of hard to say anyway, which is that for 31 years, Wichita PD had pieces of Dennis Rader sitting in evidence rooms, not theories about him, pieces, and they couldn't put the pieces together. This is not going to be one of those episodes where I'd tell you the cops were incompetent, because mostly they weren't. The 1970s and 80s did not have DNA. The agencies didn't share databases. The FBI was just starting to figure out what criminal profiling was. Wichita PD ran point on most of these cases, but Dennis Rader lived up the highway in Park City, which is a different jurisdiction, technically, even though it's right there, with a different chief and a different filing cabinet. So when I say the chase didn't close, I'm not saying the cops were idiots. I'm saying the system had specific moments in specific files where it blinked. And the cost of those blinks got carried by people who did not deserve to carry it. The episode we're about to walk through has one survivor, one wrong man, and a sketch of 18 years in the middle of someone else's life that nobody is ever going to give back to him. This isn't an episode about a slow procedural failure. It's an episode about what that failure cost in real human time. This is the second of five conversations about Dennis Rader, in a case the country has been telling wrong for 20 years. The first one was about how Dennis Rader composed his own legend, the one about him being BTK, Factor X, Minotaur, all that bullshit. This one is about the chase that that legend lived inside of. And as we go through it, I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. And if you've not done so already, press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching us so you don't miss any of our reporting. So it's April 4th, 1974, 3 months after Rader killed four members of the Otero family in their own houses, 5 months before he writes the engineering library letter that introduces BTK to the Wichita Eagle for the first time. Catherine Bright is 21. She works at the Coleman Camping Company in Wichita. You have a Coleman cooler, it's out of Wichita. Her brother Kevin is 19. Kevin had stayed over the night before because there was snow and he didn't want to drive home. Around noon, Catherine and Kevin walk into Catherine's house and Dennis Rader is already inside. He's been waiting. He shows them a gun. He ties them both up in separate bedrooms. He'd been planning a Catherine alone visit. He'd not planned for the brother. And what comes next? Rader makes a mistake that almost saves the entire case. He underestimates a 19-year-old. Kevin Bright works his way out of the restraints. He fights Rader. Rader pulls his gun and shoots him in the forehead. Kevin keeps fighting. Rader shoots him again near the mouth. Kevin plays dead on the floor. Rader, by his own account later, panics. He goes back to Catherine and stabs her. Then he runs out the back. Kevin gets up. He's been shot twice. One bullet is still inside his head. He runs out the front, flags down a neighbor, gets driven to Wesley Medical Center. He goes into emergency surgery. Catherine arrives at the same hospital. She dies on the table during her own surgery hours later. And here's the part to actually hold on to before Kevin Bright goes under for surgery. While he still has one of Dennis Rader's bullets in his head, detectives walk into the hospital room and ask him for a description of the man. He gives them one. A police sketch artist comes in. Kevin describes a face. The artist draws it 19 days later on April 23rd, 1974. The Wichita Eagle prints that sketch on the front page. Now, you don't have to take my word for how good Kevin Bright's description was. You can actually take Dennis Rader's, because years later in his own confession, he said this about that sketch. In his own words, he did a fairly good description of me. And I thought the picture in the newspaper was uncomfortably close to me, but no one ever came for me. I want to say this. This is a weird personal observation that I made while living in Wichita. Just a year after Dennis Rader was caught in 2006, there's a lot of people in Wichita, Kansas that look like Dennis Rader. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it is. Have you ever lived in a town where there's just kind of a contagious look? It's not that everybody's related or anything like that, but there's just kind of a look that people have, a lot of them. And men of his age in Wichita, Kansas, for a long period of time, many of them resembled BTK. That's probably also how he got away with it for so long, because it is a very generic look, a very common look. Honest to God, in 2006, I felt like if I went through the mall or went anywhere around town, I could find five BTK lookalikes that could play him in a movie. I worked with someone in radio that did play him in a docuseries on Discovery. And he didn't even that much look like BTK, but when they got him dressed up like him, he looked like BTK. It's a weirdness to it. But if you want to chameleon yourself into a society and not stand out, I guess find the look that everyone else is rocking. And I don't know that he even did that on purpose. It just seems more like a byproduct of who he was. Very average, very boring, very blah, middle-aged man. Unremarkable in every sense of the word. That's the man you're trying to catch, telling you in writing that your sketch was good. Wichita walked past that sketch for 31 years. October 1974, 6 months after the sketch, somebody walks into the Wichita Public Library and slips a typed letter into an engineering textbook. The letter is addressed to the Wichita Eagle. The Eagle gets an anonymous phone call telling them where to look. They find it. It claims responsibility for the Otero killings. It contains crime scene details only the killer could know. It coins the name BTK for the first time in writing. The police verify it's him. They have his prose. They have his syntax. They have a typewriter sample. They have his self-given name. They have his confession in his own words to the details and the deaths of four people. They do not have him. And the thing about that letter, the documentaries gloss over, is that as of October 1974, Wichita PD officially knows there is one person doing this. They have the typewriter, they have the syntax, they have the brand. What they don't have is a network to compare a single typewriter against every machine in every business in every church in every school in Park City or in the area. They don't know he's in Park City yet. That match would have been the case in 1974, but that match is never made. December 8th, 1977, Nancy Fox is killed in her own duplex. 3 weeks before Christmas, she's 25. She works two jobs, one of them at Helzberg Diamonds. The next morning, a killer himself calls 911 from a payphone to report her body. The dispatcher records the call. Wichita PD now has his voice on tape. So just for a second here, you got the typewriter, the sketch, the syntax, the voice on the table. Oh, it's all in front of you. It's a substantial evidentiary base. And they had it in 1977. And then comes 1978. Late January 1978. The Shirley Locks poem arrives at the Wichita Eagle. The clerk who opens the envelope thinks for a second, it's a Valentine. February 10th, 1978, the Cake TV letter, a Factor X letter. We spent the last episode talking about Police Chief Richard Lemoyne calls a press conference, says the words BTK Strangler in public for the first time, and Wichita officially has the brand, but they still don't have the man. April 28th, 1979, a 63-year-old woman named Anna Williams gets home late from a square dance. She picks up the phone to call her daughter. The line is dead. She walks to a neighbor's house. Dennis Rader has been sitting inside Anna Williams' house for hours. he'd cut her phone line, broken in the back, and waited in the dark for an older woman who, by all rights, should have come home that night. She didn't. She stopped at her daughter's place. Eventually, he got bored and left. Months later, Anna Williams gets a package in the mail, some of her own belongings taken from inside her own house, a poem titled, "Oh, Anna, Why Didn't You Appear?" An identical package arrives at Cake TV. Anna Williams moved out of state shortly after that. She died years later before the man who'd waited for her in the dark was ever caught. And let me underline this one. Anna Williams is the second person who survived Dennis Rader by sheer luck. Kevin Bright lived because Dennis Rader is a worse shot than he is a stalker. Anna Williams lived because she stopped at her daughter's house for an extra hour. Two narrow misses, two pieces of evidence, a sketch, and then a poem, two chances to catch him. And the pieces sit in different files. August of 1979, Wichita PD finally releases the 1977 dispatcher recording on every TV and radio station in the city. They get more than 100 tips the first day, and none of them lead to Dennis Rader, which is, on its face, hard to believe. His voice is on Wichita TV. His co-workers at ADT have presumably heard him speak for 5 years. Nobody calls it in. There's a reason for that, and we're going to spend the entire next episode on it. For now, the short version, Dennis Rader did not sound like the killer Wichita was imagining. He sounded like the alarm installer Wichita already knew. And then he goes mostly quiet. Almost. April of 1985, Maureen Hedge, 63, a widow living alone in Park City, Kansas, killed in her own bedroom. Her body found a week later in a ditch outside town. Maureen Hedge lived on Independence Street. Dennis Rader lived on Independence Street. They were neighbors. The man who killed Maureen Hedge walked the night he killed her from her front door to her own back door. He went home. He went to bed. Park City PD investigates her death. They don't connect Maureen Hedge to BTK, though. BTK, in their official thinking, is a Wichita killer. He couldn't possibly go the half mile up the road and strike Park City. Though it's like right there. But it's 1978, different agency, different file. The man who killed her would not be officially connected to her death by anybody in law enforcement until he confessed to it himself 20 years later, in 2005, he killed a woman from his own street. The system that had been hunting him for 11 years did not see him. September 16th, 1986, Vicki Wergel is killed in her own home in Wichita. She's 28 years old. Her two children are in the house at the time. Her husband, Bill, comes home from his job for lunch and finds her. He calls the police. He is, by every honest account, hysterical. He cannot answer the questions cleanly. He fails to polygraph because he's a man whose wife has just been murdered and he cannot hold himself together enough to pass a polygraph. No one could at that moment. The police take the failed polygraphs as a confession or a confirmation. They never seriously move off of him. And here is the part of the file that just, yeah. In 1986, BTK had been publicly quiet since 1979. The press had stopped writing about him. The Wichita PD task force had been folded into smaller, lower-funded operations. So when Vicki Wergel was killed, with all of the BTK signatures, the bindings, the strangulations, the staging, Wichita PD did not file it under BTK. They filed it as domestic, even though the man they had on tape, on a sketch, on a typewriter from a decade earlier, had every fingerprint of being the man who'd actually done this. They didn't see him because they weren't looking for him in this file. Remember, no computers. No, oh, that popped back into her. That looks a lot like that, Bill. Bill Wergel was a suspect in his own wife's murder for 18 years. His daughter Stephanie was 9 when her mother was killed. Her son Brandon, or his son Brandon, was 2. They went to school in Wichita. They had teachers and classmates who, for the next decade and a half, believed Bill Wirkle was the man who killed Vicki Wirkle. Stephanie heard it in the playground. Brandon learned in middle school from a classmate that his father was supposed to have killed his mother. 18 Christmases, 18 school years, 18 birthdays, 18 times Bill Wirkle had to walk into a parent-teacher conference and meet the eyes of a teacher who thought she was sitting across from a murderer. And he hadn't killed anyone. In March 2004, Dennis Rader had been silent for 13 years. The Wichita Eagle had just run a 13th anniversary special article on the Otero killings. Why not do an anniversary piece on something as bright and cheery as that? We'll get into what that article triggered when we get to the last episode. But the immediate trigger is this. Dennis Rader's vanity cannot tolerate a 30-year retrospective that doesn't lead with him. He mails a letter to the Wichita Eagle. Inside the envelope is a photocopy of Vicki Wirkle's stolen driver's license, which had been missing from her house since September of 1986. 3 photographs of her body, things only the killer of Vicki Wirkle could have. The letter is what sets Bill Wirkle free. It took the actual killer of Vicki Wirkle mailing her stolen ID to a local newspaper before the Wichita Police Department officially moved off the husband they'd been suspecting for 18 years. And the reason that matters, the reason it should matter to you, is that the moment the case finally cracks open is not a moment Wichita PD has earned. It is a moment the killer handed them by accident. Because he could not tolerate being on the front page. He could not tolerate getting credit for that crime. That's the chase, or more accurately, that is the file. The standard story we tell about Dennis Rader is that he was too smart for the police. The file does not say that. The file says the police had pieces, a sketch, a confession, a letter, a typewriter sample, a voice tape, a sealed package, and a poem. 2 survivors who lived to give descriptions. A widow killed by a man who lived on her own street. And 18 years of attention misallocated to a husband who had not killed his wife. The pieces didn't get put together until the killer himself dropped the last piece in a mailbox. That's not the story of a mastermind. That's the story of a system in a small city that did not know how to look at its own data. And it's a story of a cost paid by a family BTK had already destroyed once, paid a second time for 18 years by an agency that was supposed to find him. That's the second uncomfortable truth of this series. The chase didn't close because the cops finally caught him. The chase closed because he stopped running himself. In our next chapter, the costumes, the day jobs, the church positions, the Cub Scout pick, the city compliance officer truck, the roles he wore, and the reason that even when people who knew Dennis Rader saw something wrong with him, even when they put it in writing, nobody connected what they were seeing to the man Wichita was hunting. That's next. Press subscribe so you don't miss it, and give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.